Blog Talk Radio.
Listen, this is Mike's music. He composed this disco. Funny. Hi, everyone. This is Justine Rotolo, also known as Miss ADD. I want to welcome everyone to the program as we continue talking about addiction begins with ADD. But before I bring Sean on the phone, I just wanted to remind everybody about the two adult support groups that I run in the Los Angeles area, and I run them for CHAD, Children and Adults with ADD. So Wednesday night, it's in Torrance, California at 2785 Pacific Coast Highway, located at the Center for Learning Unlimited, and the group starts at 7:30, ends at 9. Please come by. We're starting to do exercises from my workbook that's due out probably in the summer. And then on Thursday night, I'm on the west side in Culver City. It's at the Share Building, 6666 Green Valley Circle. That group has been going on since almost a year, since last June. And again, we're doing exercises from the workbook there. And it's Thursday night from 6 to 7:30. And in addition to that, I just wanted to remind everybody, if you haven't already seen my other book, which is ADD Land, The Gift of ADD, please go on Amazon or on my website, missadd.com, to purchase the book. And in addition to that, you can also listen to other podcasts on my website, missadd.com, or on Blog Talk Radio. So I'm going to bring Sean on now. Sean, say hello.
Hello, everyone.
Great. So Sean works with me now. He's actually my addiction specialist. So he works with all the people in the world of ADD, as you have as well,
yes,
Sean, and understands probably a little bit more about where that came from for you. Dopamine levels are a little less than most people, I guess you could say.
Probably. And, you know, my story kind of started early, and I was blessed with a wonderful family. However, my brother has some very serious ADD and some other learning disabilities, and so I always thought that, you know, I was normal because I was nowhere near his kind of level.
Right.
So it was not something that really became apparent to me until high school area, and by that time I had already, you know, found my own way to cope with that.
Were you on meds?
Not until high school.
Okay, so like freshman year of high school?
I think I started the end of sophomore year.
And did they help?
They did, but by that time I was already, you know, kind of self-medicating with other substances.
Okay. And you were pretty good, like my own son was, at hiding it from,
yeah,
from people. And so would you say that your drug of choice to start out with was marijuana?
Yeah.
And why did you pick that?
Well, actually, I'd say probably my first drug of choice was food.
Okay.
Because that was, you know, socially acceptable.
Right.
And so, you know, I would get angry or sad or mad, or just feel uncomfortable, or I also happen to just like to eat. And so that became my thing.
Was it sugar-related food or all different? Like carbs more than? More
just
than?
Whatever.
Okay.
It was just something to do, I think, sometimes. But then once I got end of eighth grade, beginning of high school area, started drinking and smoking pot, and that kind of, once I did that, I was like, excellent, I found something that, you know, works.
Is it, so I heard when Chris got his chip, when I was up there for his year, the guy that spoke supposedly is in the back of the big book, and he talked about the first time he ever had a beer. He was 15, and he was in Israel, And it was like he still to this day can remember that feeling of his first beer. Is that what happened to you?
For me, it wasn't as immediate.
Okay.
I think I might have read that story, and some people have that moment. For me, it was once the effect took hold and I stopped caring so much about what everyone else thought and, you know, what I thought, and my mind stopped running, you know, 2 million miles an hour. And all of a sudden it was just like, I can be here and be okay.
Okay. I get that. So tell everybody about what happened when, how did you get to rehab and that whole thing?
So I started using in high school, as I said, and it started out as kind of like whenever I could get it, because we couldn't even drive at that point. So it was kind of just, you know, whatever worked. And I played sports, and so it was spending a lot of time with other kids. So if someone had an older brother who could go find some, and then like he could steal some or like bribe his brother to get him some too. And then once I could drive, it got a lot easier, because then me and my friends would be doing a whole bunch of stuff, and, you know.
Fake ID world, or?
Yeah.
Okay.
I had a fake ID. And
okay.
So then kept using, and I would do anything I could find, really. And then went to the University of Arizona and was unsupervised and didn't have anyone checking up on me for the first time, and shit got out of hand real quick.
Can we talk about that for a minute? Let me stop you right there. One of the things that I tell parents of kids that I work with that have attention deficit disorder and they want to send them away, would you suggest that if they are using and the parents know that, even if, you know, the parents are enabling and saying, well, you know, it's just normal and they're just dabbling in marijuana or alcohol, would you tell them to be careful about sending them away?
Absolutely. And I can only speak from the kids' side of the whole situation, because I don't have any kids. But
thank God.
Right? I'm not at that point in my life.
Not old enough.
No. Right. But I did have friends who were sent away. And that, in every case that I know of, you know, with people that I've spoken to, caused more harm to that parental relationship, the father-son or father-daughter or mother-daughter, the parental relationship with their kid, than could ever be fixed by, you know, them center that you're sending your child to could fix. And by that, I don't necessarily mean they shouldn't get help, but I'm saying in every case where I had someone sent away to either Utah, or I had a friend who was sent to Northern California, which is a long distance away from their parents.
Right.
It's almost like, well, my parents don't care anymore, and
right,
they're just, they don't love me, and I'm a problem, so they send me to get fixed by someone else in a different state.
Right. So now you're, okay, we misunderstood each other. You're talking about these places that people send their kids to when they're using drugs or they're
misbehaving,
oppositional, defiant. Yeah, I agree with you. That is not a good place, because they feel very much abandoned.
Right.
But I guess the question I was asking you was, do you think it was a good idea that your parents sent you away to college? Because
that is definitely a case-by-case basis. And some kids getting the independence and realizing that they need to get their stuff together and, you know, mommy's not there to do their laundry or to remind them that they have, you know, a commitment tomorrow. For some people, I know that that can definitely wake them up and, like, get them going, and for other people it can be a disaster, and in my case it was definitely a disaster.
So you would suggest, as I've suggested to parents, is that probably their junior or senior year we start helping them grow up. So we have them do their laundry, or we have them get themselves up.
Right.
Instead of mommy or daddy getting them out of bed.
It definitely can't hurt, because
right.
if you're sending your kid away and you're asking them to adjust to a whole new lifestyle where they're living on their own with a bunch of other kids that are 18 to 20 years old, and no one's there to hold their hand, no one's there to help them, the least you can do is prepare them for the simple stuff that just needs to happen. You need to wake up, you need to have, you know, proper hygiene stuff going on, you need
right.
to do your laundry on a regular basis. And if you're already used to doing that, then at least you don't have to worry so much about that, and you can worry more about, like, the bigger things. Like, honestly, one of the ones that I saw a bunch of people struggle with was the whole, I know I have class tomorrow at 8 a.m., but all my friends are hanging out until 2 a.m., and yes, I'll be really tired, but I want to see my friends.
Right.
Like, that's, if on top of that, the next day when they wake up, they're like, oh, I haven't done laundry in a week, and I have no clothes, and I woke up 30 minutes late for class because I'm not used to waking myself up, and I can't find my toothbrush, the chance of them, you know, getting up and going to class is probably less.
Yeah, and now here's the other thing. I want to make a suggestion to people who are listening who have kids going off to school, and especially if they have ADD. For the most part, I wouldn't say we're really morning people. I mean, I am now, but that's because of a lot of different reasons. But I remember when I was back in the Stone Age, when I was your age, I couldn't get up very easily. So I would suggest that possibly they don't get 8 o'clock classes, that they get later
if at all
classes.
Possible, obviously.
Yeah, yeah, because it's hard.
I would agree. I am definitely not a morning person, and that doesn't have to be a detriment, you know?
No, it doesn't. And you can always overcome certain things. I mean, if you have to get up at 8 because it's the only class you can get, then you got to figure out a way to do it. It's part
right.
of that growing up process. So talk about college for the period of time that you were there.
So I went to University of Arizona, and I went to the orientation, and the orientation where you're supposed to, like, get ready to be a college student and, like, figure out where you're going to live and figure out your classes and all that, and I ended up not so much doing that and more just partying during orientation, and then that didn't stop. I don't think I went to I didn't go to very many classes, and it was mainly just party, 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 drugs, fun stuff.
Right. And so hang on 1 minute. Do we have somebody that's... Okay, sorry. They just wanted to listen.
Oh.
There's somebody listening to us online. So after that, you went home, and your mom, I guess, discovered that something wasn't right?
By the time I lasted until Thanksgiving, or I guess I lasted through November, and that was not very long. And I got home, and I was a train wreck because I had built up various addictions that were hard to keep up when you're 19 years old living at home with your mother and keeping it a secret. And so, yeah, she eventually found out. I had a run-in with the police. Luckily, nothing happened.
Right.
Because I wasn't...
Arrested
or anything. But she was called to come pick me up, and
that's always fun.
Yeah, it was not good. We had a long talk after that.
I bet.
And I don't remember a lot of the time between when I got back, like the beginning of December, and the time when I went into treatment, which was January 31st, 2012.
So how long was it? You went into inpatient, correct?
It was intensive outpatient program with a sober living attached.
Okay.
So it's it has a lot of therapy stuff going on, as well as, like, I lived at the house that was connected with.
Was that helpful, the process, the therapy?
Yes, it was.
Can you tell everybody why? Because here's my experience. When Chris was 19 and I put him into an outpatient rehab facility, they didn't do much with process, as we call it, therapy, okay? And I felt that was something he really needed. So maybe you can talk about why that was so important for you.
I think for a lot of people, it's important to work through the reasons that they have these built-up emotions or problems that they are trying to cover up a lot of times with using. And whether that is through a 12-step program or through therapy or however you can work it, I think that that's definitely something that helps.
So the whole... Because a lot of using drugs and alcohol is self-medicating. And being able to discover, I guess, what it is that we're self-medicating can be very helpful.
Definitely.
In the process of recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, what I didn't say before is Sean is 22 in 3 years. In 3 years in sobriety. So, I mean, you know, that's amazing for you to be that young and for doing it this long. And what do you think has kept you sober for 3 years?
I think that, well, I have stayed sober through working in Alcoholics Anonymous, a 12-step program, and that's, you know, I think that there are a lot of different ways to approach relapse prevention, I guess, which would be kind of what's helped keep me sober. And one of the most common ones for me is thinking about where I would end up. You know, I think about what it was like before I got sober, and it was not pretty. No one enjoyed it. You know, I didn't like it. My family didn't like it. And then I look at the situation that I have now, and the change in what my relationships are. You know, I have people in my life that are awesome, and I wouldn't have that if I wasn't sober, because I'm not the same person.
Right. And you have good relationships with your family.
Right.
That before was difficult.
Definitely.
Because of the using and, you know, whatever. But here's something that I want everybody to hear, because I think this is important. So Sean didn't go back, well, went back to college at Santa Monica City College, which is a 2-year college, right?
Right.
Great school. But it's interesting. I think the ADD kind of puts us in a place sometimes in school where general ed classes can be pretty boring.
Yep.
Math, English, it's like, oh, my God. This is so boring, I want to kill myself. Not literally. Okay.
Right.
So he decided to go to LMU and get his degree as a CADAC counselor, or what do they call it?
It's now called the CCAP program.
Okay.
It's right now they're merging several different certificate programs in the state of California into one kind of overarching certificate, which is the CCAP program. But CADAC was what it used to be called, and it's a Certified Alcohol and Drug
Counselor. Right, which is great. And then I think after that's over, you're going to go back to college. So the reason I bring this up is because, and I think you'll agree with me, I think parents need to understand that if your child is working through sobriety, or you're adolescent, or you're a young adult, don't push them into school while they're doing this. Because I believe, like with Chris, I've told him, when you're ready, you'll go back. You know, he's a year now. He's got a really good job, so he may decide he doesn't want to go to college. That's okay with me, as long as he stays sober and has a happy life. But for a lot of people, there's that pressure, right, of you got to go to school, you got to go to school, and that pressure can throw them off center.
I think it's definitely a case-by-case basis about what a person can handle at that point in time. Because I know some people where their thing is school. They can do that. They're good at that. And that's what they like to do because they're good at it. And so that can really help them because it's something that they're passionate about and it gives them something to do. And
right.
For other people, it's something that they feel they're forced to do.
Right.
And that can definitely not necessarily be a great thing.
Yeah, especially when they get the message of, I'm not good enough. If I don't go to school, then I'm not good enough, which isn't true.
Right, and that message is probably one of the hardest for a lot of people, whether they have ADD, don't have ADD, suffer from addiction or don't. I mean, no one, I don't think, wants to be told that they're not good enough.
Right, exactly.
Or at least they don't want to feel that way.
Right, right. And there's a lot of that, and especially in the ADD population, there's a lot of issues with school. Not because this isn't people who are a bright population, because we are.
Right.
We have struggles with organization, and that can be a big part of not only physical organization, but the mental, the sequencing, you know, being able to see something and say, okay, this is what I do first, this is what I do second. So there's difficulties there in school to begin with because of all the executive function deficits, inability to focus, procrastination. That's a huge one, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So let's get on to the topic that we said this show was going to be about. Let's talk about parents and significant others and the negative and positive in terms of, you know, recovery. So let's start with parents, since I'm a parent. Sean has been very helpful to me since he's been working with me, because I will ask him sometimes some questions about some fears, I guess, that I have related to my own son who's in sobriety, because he's 2 years behind Sean. And he relaxes me, and, you know, he'll say, relax, don't make that phone call, don't ask that question. And what have you seen that parents do wrong? Let's start with that.
Well, one thing that I think that a lot of parents don't realize, just some backstory on kind of my experience, actually, is I've worked at two treatment centers since I got sober. And so it's parent visit weekends, especially, are some of the hardest for people who, or at least in my experience, for some of the people that I've worked with. And I don't think parents realize how much power they have over their kid, and how things you say that you don't necessarily think are mean or negative can have a pretty huge impact.
Do you have an example?
I have a couple. But I think one good one is I worked with a young man whose father was a very successful man, and also drank excessively, according to his son. And it was a struggle for the son because the dad would would talk to him about, you just gotta handle your shit, like I do. I'm fine. And that's not something that a kid who has, you know, 25 days sober and has been struggling with alcoholism for years needs to hear.
Right.
It's situations like that I think can easily be avoided. And just showing your kid the respect of, this is something that you're doing, and I'm going to support you in that.
Right. And I think a lot of it has to do with education. I mean, education of what sobriety or recovery is.
Definitely.
So depending on, if you have a child, if you're listening to this program and you have an adolescent or a young adult or a husband or brother or sister or wife who's struggling with addiction, I do some research into where you're going to try and get them to and take a look at what the program is all about. Does the program educate the family as to, you know, these weekends that they're coming to visit? So, I mean, I'll give you an example. When Chris was 19, when we first tried to get him in recovery, and he was in the outpatient clinic, I'm not going to mention it, the name, every Saturday they had a family group time. And the first time we went, my ex-husband was there, and his stepsister was there. She was great. She flew out from New York so she could be there. And they all went around the room and asked all the members of the family, how do you feel about being here today? And the majority of the people in the room said, we're so proud of this person for, you know, my son or my daughter for doing, because this was a young teen group, okay, because Chris was 19. When they got to my ex-husband, he basically lambasted Chris. You know, I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm here because he was drinking. I'm so embarrassed. And we all sat there with our mouths hanging open, including Chris. Like, he was making this all about him, instead of really understanding that this should have been about Chris. And I use this as an example because there's a lot of people out there who get very angry when their kids are using drugs or alcohol, and instead of really looking inside and saying, okay, when they were growing up, maybe I had some part in this, what could it be? That's when the anger starts to dissipate instead of putting it all onto them. Like, please speak about when your parents came, because I'm sure they were very supportive.
Yeah, I was very angry when I first went
there
to treatment. Yeah, I don't, like I said before, I don't remember a ton of the time between when I got back to California and when I went into treatment, because I was using so much and it's not good for your brain and all
right.
That. But then apparently, from what I remember, I was told I was going to see a program. Like, my mom was going to make me go see, like, some treatment program. So I went and I saw it, and I didn't sign any papers. I didn't say that I was moving in or anything. Apparently, at some point, I had agreed that, like, I was going to move in the following Monday. I don't remember that.
You don't remember.
That.
Okay.
And so the next thing I know is Monday morning, when I'm still high from the night before, my mom wakes me up and puts me in the car and says, we're going shopping. And the next thing I know, we're on the freeway, not going shopping. And, like, there's a suitcase in the trunk with stuff for me, you know, like clothes.
So what happened when you got there? How did you feel when you got to the place and you had to say goodbye?
I mean, at that point, I was so over my mother that I was, like, I didn't care. Just, like, leave me alone.
Right. Because you were more angry at yourself as you look back now,
yeah,
than you were at her. But that's where you called displaced anger. You're going to throw it on her. I got that
Definitely.
From Chris when we put him in to the even, it was outpatient, but he was so angry at me. I had never seen that before. And how about your dad?
I didn't have much of a relationship with my dad at the time.
Okay.
I'd see him occasionally, but I lived with my mom, and I'd spend time, like, it's not that I would never see him. It just wasn't nearly as much, and he didn't cause as much of a problem for me when I was trying to get high, so I just didn't care.
Right.
Like, I was going to be angry at you if you didn't let me.
Right.
Or got in my way in some way, and if there was no issue, then you didn't exist. I just kind of, like, blocked you out and moved along with what I needed to do.
Right.
And so I didn't talk to either of my parents for the first, I think, like, 5 or 6 weeks.
Wow.
I'm assuming they would get, like, progress report type
right.
things, because I had to sign a paper to say that they could talk to my parents, and I knew if I didn't sign it, they'd, like, disown me. So I know that they were talking, and they'd ask me, like, do you want to talk to your parents? And I'd be like, hell no, absolutely not. Never want to talk to them again. And they didn't push me into that, which was probably a good thing, because if I had been forced to have a meeting with them in the first bit, it would not have been good.
Right. Right.
When
did you, so at 6 weeks, was that a period of time where the anger started to dissipate a little bit?
It had already started to dissipate, and it had turned into, like, me dreading having the meeting with them, because the program essentially told me, like, you need to be honest and tell them what was happening and, like, what's going on now and, like, how you're doing and all that stuff. And I was deathly afraid to tell them, like, they were going to disown me or, like, never talk to me again or something. Which didn't happen.
No, because I do know your parents, and they're really good people, and I know how much they love you and your brother and sister, so, you know, I know that both of them are very proud of you for what you've done. But, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk about a little bit is enabling, okay?
Yes. Absolutely.
Which I was a classic enabler with my son, because, you know, we all want to live in that big river in Egypt called the Nile, right? Because why would we want to admit that our son or daughter is a drug addict or an alcoholic, you know, or
yeah.
a foodaholic or whatever you want to, whatever kind of ick that there is. But so one of the things I've heard, because Dr. Drew is basically my hero. I really like him a lot. I think he's great. And one of the things I heard him say one time on a podcast is he has seen more young people die in their own beds than out in the street. Because you and I have had this conversation where there are parents that should be probably throwing their kids out of the house at this point, and they're not doing it because they're terrified of what are they going to do, the consequences, how are they going to, they're going to die. And so I guess Dr. Drew's point was, well, if you let them stay home and enable their behavior by knowing that they're shooting heroin or smoking marijuana or drinking all the time, they're going to die. Whether they're, and most of the time it's more prevalent in their own beds.
Or crashing daddy's car or something like that, yeah. And
so how would you, what would you suggest to parents who are listening right now that are struggling with kids that are basically taking advantage of being at home? They're drinking and they're basically saying F you to everybody in the house. What would be your suggestion?
It's one of the hardest situations that I can think of. Me not being a parent, I can't speak from experience, obviously, but it's definitely one of those things that they're not, your kid isn't going to change unless there's some sort of force behind it. And if they're sitting at home, even if, you know, you get mad at them for using, or whatever, if they know that, like, okay, well, dad's going to yell at me and then he's going to leave and then I can do whatever I want, or whatever the situation is, you know, it's, no one's going to change unless they're forced to in a lot of these situations.
Right.
And that's honestly probably the hardest thing I can imagine is having to tell your kid, you know, you're gone, get out.
Because somebody was telling me, I believe it was one of my clients was telling me that their older son, they've kicked them out, and they have been getting phone calls, like, periodically when it rains in Southern California, which hasn't been doing a lot of, evidenced by our drought. But I guess one night they got a phone call, and so what they did was they brought the I'm trying to think where the kid was, in some back alley or something. So what they did was they put a care package together and went and brought him a blanket and a cover, you know, for his head, and some food. And he cried when she got there and said, I can't believe you won't let me come home. And she said, I can't believe you won't admit you have a disease. And she left. But she brought him some food and some clothing and whatever else he needed. And I have to tell you, I give her a lot of credit, because that has to be, like you just said, one of the most difficult things to do, to watch your child spiraling. But the enabling process causes a lot of resentment,
yeah,
on the part of the person who's doing the enabling. So it's the same thing for people who are married to alcoholics and drug addicts. You know, enabling that is the worst thing that you can do, especially if you have children. And these children,
yeah,
are seeing all this.
It's not setting a good example of the parental role. You're, the one thing that I think is pretty interesting about psychology is that a lot of how you act is how you learn to act. And when you come from a dysfunctional place and you don't learn these the way to act around certain people or the way to parent, then how, like, you're going to revert to how it's been for you.
Exactly. Right. So the other thing too is, when you come from a family of alcoholics, you have to be careful and hypervigilant about you having the gene for the disease of alcoholism.
Definitely.
Right? So I think it's, what's a good way to get that across to people? Is it explaining to them about what the disease is? Is it talking about how you've seen other people that have suffered with this because it's been in their family? I don't know.
I mean, I think it's one of those things that if there's, like, an example, and sitting down with your kid and saying, you know, Uncle Bill has a problem,
right,
with, you know, drinking, and he drinks too much and it causes problems in his life, and having that moment with your kid and getting honest, no matter how uncomfortable that is, like, that might be your brother, right?
Right.
And you don't, it doesn't make you happy to see it happening, but also getting honest with your kid and saying, this is something that I worry about for us because it runs in the family. We've had people who have had problems with drugs and alcohol, and getting honest so that at least your kid knows that, like, if they're going to take that risk and decide, like, well, I want to try something, maybe that you're going to sit in the back of their head and be like, hey, our family has a problem.
Right.
And they might think of that, and it might dissuade them.
So what would be your advice to, you know, if there's any adolescents listening or if there's parents of adolescents that can help them understand, what would be your advice if a kid decided, you know what, I want to try this, and their dad or their grandfather or their mom, whoever in the family is an alcoholic? This is a question I've thought about. How do you stop that process from happening, or can you?
That kind of depends, I think. I think that, you know, if addiction runs in your family, right, and you know that, and then you purposely avoid those substances, then it may, you may have that gene, and it may never manifest because you're not drinking, you're not smoking weed, you're not taking drugs, you know, versus someone who doesn't know it runs in the family or doesn't know anything about it, tries it, and then it gets hooked, and you know where that goes from there. It can be an advantage if you know that, and you're just like, I'm going to stay away. And, you know, going the other way too, though, it's one of those things that you know that, and so it's, you know, use at your own risk kind of thing.
Right, right. Yeah, and I mean, there, for parents who are listening, because I suffered a lot of guilt about, I missed so many signs, or I wasn't really looking because I didn't believe it. You're going to miss stuff because, you know, you're really good at hiding things. But also, I think you got to give yourself a break. And if it happens, then, you know, the one thing that I can say again is don't live in denial and get them the help that they need. Don't let them. Here's the worst scenario. Your son or daughter comes home from college and they're sitting around the living room drinking all day long, using drugs, and you're allowing this.
I mean, and then you continue that scenario, and one night your son decides that he wants to go get Taco Bell at 2 a.m. after drinking since, you know, 8 p.m. and then crashes the car, and all of a sudden you no longer have a son. I mean,
so scary.
Right?
So scary. And I will share this. I think I've shared this with Sean, but I will share it with everybody who's listening, and that is that one of the reasons I think my son never got a DUI is because I warned him from the time he was very young that if he ever got one, don't bother calling me, because I'm not coming to get you. And one thing he did know about me, both my boys do, is when I say something, I follow through. And I told him, you'll just sit in jail because I'm not coming to get you. So I think when you say something to your kids along those lines, you got to follow through. You got to make them understand that what I say is going to happen. I mean, do you agree?
Well, I mean, definitely. And I think that can definitely, you know, motivate someone. If the thought is you cross these lines and you're kicked out,
right,
it may cause someone to not cross those lines. However, that doesn't mean that they're not going to test those lines. And if they do, you're put in that sticky situation of, well, I made this ultimatum.
Right.
Now I have to follow through with it.
Right.
And one of the things that I think that a lot of kids, you know, don't take it, or at least I didn't take advantage of, was my dad said, you know, anytime you've been out and you don't feel like it's a good idea for you to drive, I'll come pick you up. I don't want you getting in a car. And I never took advantage of that because I thought he was lying, obviously, because that's how I was living.
Yeah.
But I honestly believe that he would have come and done that. And I think that that's probably the best thing parents can do is, that doesn't mean we're not going to have a conversation about it.
No, but I will tell you this. I did that, and I never got a phone call from Chris. But I did get one from Mike, my younger son, who does not have an alcohol or drug problem. His friend that drove him to a party was drunk, and he called me at 3 a.m. and said, could you come get me? And one of the things I told him is, I'll never be angry if you call me. If you drive drunk, then you suffer those consequences, and I don't want to, you know, run the risk of losing you or you killing somebody. You know, I had a client who is serving 10 years in prison because at 18, vehicular manslaughter, you know, and felony. I'm sorry. Vehicular felony or felony, I don't know what they call it, but he killed somebody.
Vehicular manslaughter.
You know, so, I mean, his life is ruined, you know, and I just think the parents need to really get tough when it comes to this. And also, don't just hand your kid a brand new, you know, Mercedes-Benz when they're 16 years old, because what do they have to work for towards? I mean, it's a little crazy. Where we live up in Palos Verdes, the kids drive better cars than I do at the high school. I mean, I remember that was one of the things, the first things I noticed, was their cars were nicer than mine. And I'm thinking, what's wrong with this picture, you know? So you have to think about how this is going to be perceived by your child. I'm giving you this very expensive car that you don't have to work towards. I certainly didn't grow up like that. And I know that you got a nice car, but certainly not a Mercedes, you know, and not a Porsche. But those are the kind of things that I was seeing in the parking lot. And there's a lot of drugs and alcohol, not only up here, but all over the place. And it seems to be getting younger and younger that I'm noticing, that kids are self-medicating. So you want to ask yourself as parents, why is this happening? You know, what's going on in the family, dynamics that may be causing this to happen? I get the fact that my boys went through divorce with me. You went through it. That's a big issue. But, you know, there are other things, too. Communication.
I think that families in general need to get real with the fact that there are, you know, family roles that can be filled by different family members. And I think that a lot of times the person who suffers from substance abuse is the scapegoat kind of thing. Like, if only...
The identified patient.
Right.
Yes.
If only, you know, my son Jeff would stop doing drugs, then everything would be fine.
Right.
You know, and not addressing the other issues that may be prevalent in the family. And I think that a lot of families have very dysfunctional communication systems. The way that some families talk to each other is crazy to me.
Yeah. That angry voice, that intensity, you know, I see a lot of it with kids, especially because I work in the ADD community, and these kids struggle in school and the parents come in and they're very angry because they're making this about them. They don't realize it, but they are, when they already went to high school. But they're making their grades about them. Don't set your kids up for failure, you know. Don't make it about grades. Make it about effort. I mean, you know, if your kids – I used to say to my boys, if you have all your assignments in and you've studied and you get a C, oh, well. I mean, you did the best you could.
You can only expect the most – you can expect your kid to try hard. You can't expect out of them straight A's if that's just not where they're at.
Right.
And I'm not saying that they're not capable of that.
Right.
But if they're truly trying their hardest and that's where they land, they get a C, like, that's all.
That's okay.
That's the best they could do. And, you know, sometimes you got to be happy with that.
Right. And the other thing is, for high school kids, don't hold your kid up all the time. Like, don't get them tutors for every single subject, right? Don't make everything right for them that they made wrong.
I heard
there's
the
natural
other
consequences.
I heard the other day from a kid that she was getting straight A's in, and her English teacher said that she should become a journalist because her tutor was writing all of her papers, and that they were doing some big group project for another class. And it blew my mind, because that's not how I went through school.
No.
And I might have not gotten the best grades.
Right.
But I did my work. Like, I did my own work, at least.
Right. And my boys did, too. Because here's what happens, too, and this is where I was going, is what happens when they go away to college?
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of a sudden they're dropped on their head, and they're away from home, and they've had, you know, 7 different tutors, you know, 5 days a week, and now all of a sudden... okay, I got to do this on my own.
Or even if they do get to college and you continue to get them tutors, then what happens when they get to the real world and they have to do something that they don't want to do?
Exactly. Yeah, it really doesn't work. And here's something else. There is no chance of internal motivation unless there is autonomy or independence, whatever you want to call it. Because when you have a helicopter parent that's hovering overhead all the time, they're never going to become independent and learn how to take care of themselves. Mom will take care of it, or dad will take care of it. It's not the way it works.
Or in some cases, I've seen kids who, you know, when poked and prodded to do things, they'll do them. But once they're let out on their own and don't have that hovering cattle prod to get them going... nothing gets done because they're not used to having to, like, get themselves up off the couch and stop watching Netflix to go write a paper. I mean, I know that was something that I had to deal with because I had always been, like, either I'm going to do, like, whatever work I feel like doing, and hopefully that's enough to get through class, or, you know, like... my mom would get on my ass about doing work, and then I'd have to do it, or else she wouldn't stop.
Right.
And so then, you know, I get out, and it's like, well, like, I really want to watch Orange is the New Black instead of doing my homework or Game of Thrones or whatever. Like, I'd much rather do something that's fun for me.
Right.
Then is not fun, and I didn't at one point didn't have that like drive within me to be like need to close the laptop and like get my grown up activities done, pay bills or write a paper or whatever it is.
Do me a favor and talk a little bit about, because I personally think that anybody can benefit from a 12-step program. Here's what I was going to ask. I was going to ask about can you do this? Can you talk about the steps, or you can't talk about that? No. Okay. It's anonymous, so we can't talk about that. Okay.
The whole idea of not promoting.
Okay. Oh, that's right. We can't promote. I forgot. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Okay. I got some questions. So my son is in high school. He and his friends all drink too much and get high. I think there's a trend here. He lies about everything. What a shocker. What should we do to stop this process?
Well, I mean, the first thing is confront him. If you know this is going on, you know, I'm hoping that at some point you had spoken to him about it and laying down some boundaries that... you know, some firm boundaries that he knows that if he crosses these boundaries, there are consequences.
So give me some examples, because in high school, how can you kick them out at 15?
I mean, kicking them out isn't necessarily, like, the only option. If it's things like, you know, there are consequences for coming home drunk or for doing these, you know, whatever activity it is, if there's a consequence, at least he knows what he's doing is not
acceptable.
You know, acceptable in your house.
Okay.
Because it is your house and he is, you know, under your roof.
So could you use, for example, I would think, using getting your license. So if somebody's 15
For
and
sure.
Yeah.
If you're getting high all the time, I wouldn't want you driving anyway.
Right.
So, like, you lost that right in my book.
Exactly. So they have to wait until they're proving that they're not drinking or getting high.
Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, especially since, you know, if it was just, maybe if it was just bad grades or something, like, something could be worked out. But if he's impairing himself.
Right. No,
I wouldn't want him driving anyway. If he had a car, I would have taken it away by now.
Right. So here's something I'd like you to talk about, because this is a big one. Because the drug of choice, usually for kids and adolescents, not kids, but I don't know, maybe some kids are doing it too, is marijuana, right?
It's the easiest to get.
And so what I hear all the time now, you and I hear this, is I have a card. I have a medical marijuana card. It helps my anxiety. It helps me to sleep, which I get. Some people, it really does. I get it. First of all, it's not legal here in California, okay? And I do know that it really impairs memory. The THC level is, I think, up to 24, 25%. And THC is the drug in marijuana that attaches to fatty cells in our body, and most of them are in our brain. So we get that cognitive distortion. Please talk about marijuana. Please tell everybody.
Well, one of the things, I was a super stoner. Like, I was the guy who had done all the internet research and could tell you all the facts about why weed is the solution to everything. And, you know, I think for some people it is. If you have, you know, a medical condition that can be helped, I don't see why not. That's not my place to, you know, I'm not a doctor. It's not my place to tell you that it is or isn't the right choice. But I do know that, in my case at least, it became psychologically addictive, if not necessarily super physically addictive. But it was things like, you know, I couldn't fall asleep because I was used to having that, or I couldn't. You get into the rhythm of it, and it's like people describing the same patterns of behavior that they have, an alcoholic has.
Right.
You know, I can't sleep unless I take a drink.
Right.
I can't wake up. I can't function. I need to calm my nerves before I do something.
I don't know.
All of the same activities.
I don't know any stoner that has a to-do list.
Definitely can affect motivation.
Right. Right. And we've seen this ourselves where you have a kid who's sitting home all day.
Yeah.
No goals.
Mm-hmm.
No job. And no school.
Right. And to everyone who is defending their habit, to me, I like to pose the question, have you done anything that you don't necessarily, for a lot of people, they do things that they don't necessarily, that don't necessarily line up with their, like, maybe morals, because they needed money to buy weed or,
right.
I mean, I did,
yeah.
You know, like, I stole money from my mom
yeah.
to buy weed because I didn't have any, and all of a sudden that was more important than, like, being a good son.
Right, right. And I think that that's a big red flag is when the family starts getting in the middle of this whole mix. You know, we're stealing money from our parents. We're forging checks. We're selling items in the house. Or, oh, my Adderall was stolen by Chris and sold, you know, 90 days worth when he was 19. So, you know, all these different things that you don't think about because it's all about the almighty high.
Yep.
Or getting drunk, whatever one you want to, you know, pick.
Right.
So I just think it's important that everybody who's listening, when your kids are telling you that marijuana isn't dangerous, it's very dangerous.
And my favorite are people will come up and say, you know, no one's ever died from smoking too much marijuana. And my immediate reaction to that is, you know, I've seen someone crash their car and die.
Wow.
Because they were impaired.
Stoned?
Yeah, they smoked too much weed and couldn't react.
Wow.
They were like practically falling asleep, drove off the side of the road, hit a tree.
Wow. See, that's some of the things that you don't think about, because we all think about drunk driving.
Right.
We don't think about driving on marijuana and how incredibly dangerous.
I know. I didn't. I used to smoke while driving.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and it's very dangerous. And you know what? Here's the other thing. Be very aware, this is a good topic, of manipulation.
Well, yeah.
And your addicts are the biggest manipulators in the world. And they'll say things, especially parents, they'll say things to make you feel guilty or make you feel sad, and then you'll give in to what it is that they're looking for. And then you'll get angry and resentful. So you have to be aware of when your child is trying to manipulate you.
Right. Because
they're really good at it.
Usually they're the best, because no parent wants to see, you know, my kid is trying to work me for money for drugs. No one wants that to be the case.
Right, right. So here's another question. So do you think your parents did too much for you when you were young, you know, high school? What are your thoughts for parents with that?
For me in high school, I think that early on, absolutely. And as as I went on in high school, there started to be other issues. You know, my grades started slipping because I didn't care. I stopped. You know, I had some medical issues my senior year, and barely went to school at all. And
related to?
Not related to addiction.
Okay.
However, on the subject of manipulation, I made it seem worse so that I didn't have to go to school as much.
Right, right.
And
they didn't know that.
No.
Because I wouldn't have. No.
And but I think that a lot of times parents are hoping, like, well, if I just help them through this hard time, this one phase, you know, then everything will be fine. And, you know, unfortunately, that doesn't work a lot of the time. A lot of the time, instead of the kid, like, working through this tough time and moving on, it turns into, oh, well, I mean, fantastic. Like, I'm in this tough time, but mom is just, like, she's, like, letting me do whatever I want. Or,
right.
You know, that whole idea, then they learn a new way to act with you instead of thinking, oh, this is like a one-time thing and they're just trying to help me out.
Because it's easier for them to act that way, right? The way they have to act to get what they need and what they want, than it is for them to think about recovery or sobriety.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think that it goes the same way with parents. A lot of times it's easier for the parents to just avoid conflict. Why would you provoke the conflict with your kid when you have all the stuff in your life going on too?
And I don't think it has to always be that way, because I think part of the issue here is what you and I brought up before is the patterns of communication a lot of times aren't healthy,
right,
in families. And there's an identified patient, the IP. And instead of dealing with that, then we start getting angry and we start raising our voices and there's conflict. And
right. And I think that the way, like the first question we had where her son was smoking too much pot and drinking and stuff.
Right.
I wouldn't suggest, you know, barging in there and yelling at him.
Right, right.
That's definitely not the way that I would approach it. I think that, you know, staying calm and, you know, just stating kind of the situation as it is. So in that situation, if you're going to continue to drink and smoke, I don't feel comfortable letting you get your license.
Right.
And saying it like that versus you're doing all these bad things and
right.
there's no way I'm letting you get your license and you have to do your homework and be home by 10 and you better be getting straight A's in school
right.
and, you know, tirade over, storm out. Probably
and,
gonna.
And as a, you know, as a young adult, remembering more about your teenage years than I do, what was that like for you? Did it matter? Or did it matter more when they were calm?
It depends on where your kid is at. A lot of times in the place where I was, I didn't care what they had to say, but I would actually listen if they weren't yelling at me. If they were yelling at me, I just yell back.
Right.
And it kind of escalates from there.
Right.
And then there's door slamming and running away and, you know.
Right.
I'd get a fight with my mom and be like, I can't even deal with this. I'm going for a drive and go and, like, smoke and, like, be gone for 6 hours and then come back and just hope that she wouldn't talk to me anymore.
Yeah. I mean, that's the way it works. But the way I feel, and this isn't even about addiction, this is just about teenagers and parents, is if we can spend time talking to each other instead of talking at each other, that's such a healthy thing to do. How about role modeling to your kids how you feel, talking about how you feel?
And having someone, if you have that kind of relationship, think about the power that is, that your kid, you know, maybe not 100% of the time, maybe not 50% of the time, maybe just one time they'll come to you
mm-hmm.
with something big for them. And if you can have that conversation and help your kid through that, then you're building this meaningful relationship that, you know, then they don't need to go somewhere else.
You know,
and it's not necessarily, you know, best friends with your kid.
No, they have to be parents. No.
Right.
But here's an example. So for years, I always wanted my son, Chris, who everybody, he's been on my podcast, so everybody knows about his year in sobriety. I've always wanted him to tell me how he felt. And, you know, it was difficult for him because he was masking his feelings, as, you know, he's shared with me, with alcohol. And when we were home for my mom's 95th birthday, we all went out to dinner and there was a lot of drinking that was going on. And he turned to me and said, you know, I'm feeling really sad. And I said, really, why? I was like, oh my God, this is great. What? He's telling me how he feels. He said, because I have no connection here. My connection was always drinking with all these people. And now this is the first time I'm not drinking. So I affirmed that and then said to him, I'm not drinking either. So we're going to go get through this together.
Right.
And I waited all those years for him to come to me and be able to talk to me that way. And he couldn't do that. And I lost it when he was a teenager too. That's why I try to help people understand my mistakes so that they can learn from them.
Right.
Instead of getting crazy and screaming and yelling.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a really good question. I often wonder about this. How can parents tell if this use of alcohol or marijuana is a phase or an addiction?
God. Oh, yeah, really good question, and a question I hear a lot, but also probably the hardest question to answer.
Okay.
Because it's a case-by-case basis. For one person, you know, drinking every now and then might cause such a disruption in their life that they can't do that.
Okay.
Versus someone who, you know, can go out on the weekends and do, you know, have a couple drinks and
not pass out.
Right. Not black out and
right.
like do something stupid. But I think that when it starts to when it causes problems in their life in some way, I mean, even for a lot of teens or adolescents, their first thing is, well, it doesn't cause any problems. Like, I'm doing fine in school, but if it causes problems with your relationship with your parents,
yeah,
doesn't that count as a problem in your life?
Well, to a lot of adolescents, no.
Right.
But
that's one of those things that I firmly believe counts. That counts as a problem because it's where you live. It's where you spend the majority of your time.
So I guess what then one of the red flags would be if you know that your child has had blackouts, if they've ended up in the hospital, if they drink to such an extent that they end up like that, or they take, you know, Xanax with drinking, or
a whole bunch of not so good stuff.
Right.
You know, and it's hard. I don't want to say that, like, only if bad things happen to your kid is there a problem, because I think that there are plenty of people who can just realize that. I mean, I've met some of them who realize that they never had, you know, crazy blackouts. They never had DUIs, but they realized that they drank too much and it was impacting their life in some way. But definitely, if there are these big, impactful, you know, hospitalizations or DUIs,
right,
or
right,
all of that, then that could definitely be a big red flag.
Well, wouldn't you say that part of being an addict is distorted thinking?
100%.
Okay. So to me, distorted thinking is, I just had 5 beers, but I can get in this car and drive.
Okay. One of my friends once told me a story about when he got a DUI, and he said when he talked to his mom, she said, "Why'd you get in the car after drinking that much?" And his thought wasn't, you know, why'd I get in the car, why'd I drive home? His thought was, why'd I take Sunset? There are always cops there. And the insanity of that thought, I think, really describes how distorted the thinking can be.
That is very funny. That's very funny, because that is truly an example of distorted thinking.
Right?
I mean,
a normal person would think that was an awful decision.
Yes.
I don't know what came over me, all of these things. Whereas my addict friend immediately is like, man, why'd I get caught? Didn't even think, like, oh, I probably shouldn't have done that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I can relate, since, you know, I've dealt with it, and it's and I had that kind of thinking when I was closer to your age, and, you know, I did some crazy things in my life. I drove drunk, you know, years ago when there was no such thing as MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, you know.
Fun.
But still, when I think about it, I get scared thinking about how I could have died.
Yeah.
So, you know, there I think is a little bit of the difference. Even though I was a foodaholic, I don't ever believe I was an alcoholic. So here's another question. So my daughter's in college and has a problem with alcohol. This summer, she wrecked a family car. She won't get, I don't know what this says. Should we throw her out? She won't go to rehab. Should we throw her out? How can we bring this situation to a conclusion? What steps should we take? What do you do first?
I think that if the topic has been, it sounds like you've talked to her about it.
Right.
And rehab has been brought up, and she's shot that down. And so at that point, if you feel you're getting to the point where her behavior warrants action and this needs to come to an end, I think that would be a point where your options are get help or get out. And that it's hard, but I think she probably needs a wake-up call at this point, because if, you know, the people who gave birth to her and have cared for her entire life are like, we love you, but this is ridiculous. Like, you need to get your shit together, and these are your two options.
Right.
Go somewhere where we can provide this opportunity for you to get your stuff together and move on with your life, or you have to go do you. And at that point, I don't suggest, you know, definitely don't get her, like, an apartment. I've seen families who are like, okay, we'll get her out of the house, and then they go pay for her to have an apartment and no supervision, which is even worse.
It's so stupid, yeah. No, I know, but it's a way out of sight, out of mind kind
Definitely.
Of thing. And, yeah.
And honestly, my hope is that if you can get the message across that you're serious, that she's not going to want to deal with that. A lot of people, that's really the thing, is that once they realize that you're serious, it's like, oh, like, my options are going to go live in a cardboard box at the park, or, you know,
right,
go to rehab. They choose the rehab.
Now I've heard a couple of parents say to me, I can't kick my daughter out of the house. How could
yeah.
I do that?
Yeah.
You know, which, you know, I get that, because we worry because they're girls and all that. What do you do about that? I mean,
it's a tough situation, and, you know, I think that you need to get the message across. Like, that's, at the end of the day, that's what it is you need to make it clear to them that, like, we can't be a part of this anymore. We can't be a part of you killing yourself, or at least, case scenario, hurting yourself.
Right. Right.
Well, if this goes on.
Right.
And, you know, as much as that's, it's a tough situation, and hope, I really hope that she would choose the rehab option instead of, you know, walking out of the house with a suitcase and nowhere to go.
Yeah.
But I can't guarantee that, you know?
No, and I think once we set that scenario up, we have to follow through.
Definitely.
Or nothing changes.
It can almost be worse than
yeah.
before, because she realizes that you're not willing.
Right. So I know, look, I know we can't grandstand about AA. I get that. But I will say that in 1938, two men and God got together and put this program together where millions and millions of people have been saved.
Right.
I'm just going to say that.
All the stats and facts. You can Google it.
Right. You can look it up. But here's something I do want to talk about for a minute, and that's Al-Anon. Okay? And again,
I have no experience with that.
I know
you
don't.
I've been on the other end.
It's probably the sister to AA, because Bill's wife, so it was Bob and Bill who started AA in 1938, and Bill's wife started Al-Anon for the wives, so they had a place to go and talk about their difficult times that they were experiencing while their husbands were in recovery. So I've found Al-Anon, and there's a lot of wonderful people in Al-Anon. I think what it's helped me to do is understand that I have to work on myself, that I have no business being in my son's program, and what he does is on him, and what I do is on me. And I think that's the most powerful thing of all.
And I'm sure it could help in the situation that they described with their daughter, because, I mean, I know no one wants to kick their kid out.
Right. But I've met a lot of people in Al-Anon who have kicked their kids out. And
yep.
And by doing that,
my mother. That was what got me into treatment, was my mom basically said, okay, your two options are, here's your suitcase. You can either check in at the place that we're at right now, or you can walk down the street and go find somewhere to live.
And that's what I said to Chris when he was 19. You stayed in, he didn't. But I told him, you could either go to rehab, or you can leave, because I'm not going to harbor a drug addict or an alcoholic, because I got a 16-year-old down the hall. Sorry.
Yeah, especially, it's tough, but especially if they have younger siblings.
Yeah,
I mean,
and you did.
I did.
Yeah, because you were the oldest, like Chris. So, you know, I just think everybody should look into Al-Anon. Even if your child is still using, your adolescent, your husband, your sister, your brother, it can help everybody. It helps you to understand you can't fix anybody. The only person that you can fix is you. And it also helps you understand, this is something big for me. Don't pour their alcohol down the drain. They're just going to get more. And don't throw their marijuana out because they're just going to find more. That's not the answer. The answer is, whether they're using or not, you're going to show them that you love them, but you're going to do the right thing. And going to those rooms and talking to those people, you'll get some answers for things that you're struggling with. And so here's another question. What do you think is the biggest stumbling block for young adults, getting into recovery?
I know a lot of people struggle with the aspect of, you know, I have a friend who got sober at 15. So 15 years old saying, I'm never going to drink or do drugs ever again. And I'm 15 and I could live to be 80.
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
Or, you know, I got sober at 19. The fact that, like,
wow,
I'm not even 21. Like, I can't even legally buy a beer.
Right.
And I'm saying I'm never going to drink again.
Right.
And so a lot of people, or just the whole idea of I'm too young, like, kids party, who cares? It's not a big deal. Kids talk themselves out of recovery more than anyone I've ever met.
Is it because they're afraid they're not going to have fun?
A lot of times. Or that a lot of times it's dealing with being different.
Okay. It's like having ADD.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, there's so many, I mean, I heard a stat when I was first getting sober that some ridiculously small percentage of people under the age of 20 get a year or whatever. And I thought that was ridiculous because I have a group of people around me and we're all, you know, my community, we're all sober and we're all doing our thing. We're all young.
Right.
And so I thought that was ridiculous, and they're just making stuff up. And then you look at the people who come in for just a meeting or a couple or whatever it is. And I think that a big reason, like probably the top three, are that they don't want it when they're forced into it without, you know, any intention of staying sober. That'll be a big one, because if they don't want to stay sober, they're not going to.
And you can't – see, here's the other thing, and I want parents to understand this, is that, you know, you can't coerce, you can't threaten, you can't do any of that to get your child into recovery.
That doesn't mean don't get them help.
Exactly.
Because, you know, once you get everything out of their system – I've found that a lot of people are a lot more open and willing,
mm-hmm,
but they need some time to detox.
Right.
Kind of deal. And even if it's not a super prevalent thing, like you're not drinking, you know, you're not drinking a gallon of whiskey every day, that doesn't mean that you're not going to have some, you know, some effects
from the alcohol.
Right.
But I think, When I said that before, definitely I agree with you. Teenagers, get them in. Get them into rehab. Get them into help right away. Get them help. When they're over 18, the problem becomes
you can't force them,
right,
to do anything. And that's where the whole, you can't force them to go to rehab, but you can also say you can't live in my house.
Exactly.
And that's a big motivator. I know it was for me, and it infuriated me at the beginning. I was so angry because, you know, everyone, the people at the place I went to would tell me, you can leave whenever you want. And I would be so angry because I knew I had nowhere to go, and I would yell, and be, no, you don't understand. I can't leave because I have nowhere to go.
Let me ask you something. Do you really believe that if you had left, your mom would have said you can't come home?
Yeah, she's stubborn.
Okay. No, I agree with that. I think that's great. I just wanted to know if you truly believe that.
Yeah, and she was very angry and very scared when...
Yeah, I understand that.
When the whole thing happened. So I believe it. I never tested it, but because I think at that point, once I got into treatment and kind of went through the detox process and got everything out of my system and was like a normal human being again, I kind of realized, like, I had my, you know, the opening of my eyes moment kind of thing where this is probably the better decision. But I know for a lot of people that's not how it is.
No. Especially at the age that you went into recovery at. I mean, you know, when Chris went in the second time, he was 26. You know, that's a little older, and you got a lot less partying going on at that age than
right.
you do at 19, 20, 21. So I think it was, he tells me that he's happy I did what I did when he was 19 because he got a, you know, a belly full of AA, so it made him really understand
right.
what that was all about.
The whole idea being you plant the seed and they
yeah.
know, you know.
Yeah.
Once they know that there's an option and, like, there's always somewhere where they can go to get help, whether it be you and asking for, you know, going to treatment or whatever, it's one of those things that once you plant the seed, also, it makes the drinking a lot less fun, from
mm-hmm.
what I've heard.
Yep. Yeah.
Because all of a sudden you're like, yeah, I shouldn't be doing this.
Right.
This is a bad idea.
Right.
And that's just kind of hanging in the back of your head the whole time.
Yeah. Well, you know how I respect you for what you've accomplished, because at your young age to have 3 years is amazing. And again, Sean is now with me in my practice, and working on his degree, which is awesome. And, you know, the kids relate to him better. I'm not a substance abuse counselor, so, you know, even just coming to me, they're not going to relate to me as well as they relate to you, because they see at your young age you were able to do that. And then your other friend from last night who is 18 and has 3 years, which is amazing. So,
yeah.
I mean, there's so many people out there who have benefited from rehab, AA, whatever, you know, program, inpatient, outpatient, whatever you can do to get your young adolescent into help. Please, by all means, listen to what we're saying to you. Don't enable your children. Don't yell at them. That doesn't help. I know you're angry. Go to Al-Anon. I've seen a lot of people screaming and yelling in Al-Anon and crying. And, you know, make sure you and your husband, whether you're together or not, can figure out a way to be together on this so you can help your kids. This, I can't see how fast this time goes by. It's amazing. So we're almost done. And I just want to, you know, remind everybody that we're here. If you need any help and you want to ask Sean any questions, you certainly can get him also through my website. I'm going to probably get you on the website so people know that you're available.
All right.
But we're here for you. So
yep.
Thank you, Sean, for being on the show today. I really enjoyed having you on. This was great. I think we've helped a lot of people. And we had somebody that called in but really didn't want to talk, just wanted to listen. I don't know if that was one of your relatives.
I don't know, maybe.
Anybody got a 508 area code?
Not off the top of my head.
Okay,
but...
so we don't know who that was, but that was great. I'm glad they called in to listen for a while. So we're going to continue. I'm going to continue, and Sean, of course, is going to be on the show again, Addiction Begins with ADD. And it isn't only, addiction is not only with attention deficit disorder, but I've certainly met a number of people with it, and Sean has as well. So you just want to keep an eye on your kids, your adolescents, if there's attention deficit disorder in the family, and also, more important, if there's a history of alcoholism.
Definitely.
So I want to tell everybody to have a great day. Please stay in the moment. Thank you, Sean, for being on the show. And I will see you hopefully next week. Have a great week.